get that oriented.
Picking up from the last interview, I really had planned to go into the next step, which was courtship and marriage and more of your adult activities. And perhaps then we can go back and you can bring in some of the religious and Jewish affiliations later. But I thought that we had worked up to, we've worked through your early childhood and your education, and we've gone through we'd asked you some questions about your adolescent years. And so I thought it would be a good point to continue from your courtship and marriage.
Howard's right around here. Do you want to get his view of the situation?
Well, right now we have to do it from your view. We'll have to come back and interview him separately.
Well, let's see, we got married in the middle of World War II. So we'll be married 35 years this fall. And Howard is local. He grew up on Free Street, and I grew up on Woodmont Street, which is in the same area, but we didn't know each other. Howard is 6 and a half years older than I am, and we met in a bar, which, and how this came about was the law students at Pitt used to congregate with one of the professors at the Boot and Saddle, it's there in the Webster Hall, just for beer. And this particular professor, who's now passed away, was an alcoholic, and he would go into St. Francis periodically to get dried out, and Howard was a resident at St. Francis in the psychiatric. He had a psychiatric residency there. So part of his responsibility was to take care of this dry out ward. And I was over there with about 5, 6, 7, 8 law students plus the professor, and Howard came into the Boot and Saddle bar, and Blackie had been his doctor, so he immediately called Howard over, and we got introduced, and that was how we met him. And I met him, and then I was in my last year in law school. He was in the last year of his residency at St. Francis. And we went out a little bit at home. And then when I graduated law school, I got a job in Washington. I was working down there. He joined the Army, and he was stationed in Columbia, South Carolina. He came through Washington and had gotten where I was living and called me up. And this was during the war. This was 1942. And I don't know, we got married in Leavenworth, Kansas, where he was subsequently stationed. And we didn't tell anybody. We kind of eloped because I had gone out to see him out there, and then we just decided that we would get married. Tell anybody.
In where, Kansas?
Leavenworth.
Okay.
Which was where the Army of Kansas was.
If it's not too personal, why did you decide not to tell your family then?
It's very
or is that too personal?
No, it's not too personal. It's very difficult to remember, one's feelings, when it gets back. Part of it was neither of us, wanted a big wedding. I think I was in reacting. This was during a period of time I think I was reacting to certain middle class Jewish standards of behavior, which I was adapted many of them, but I remember at the time feeling, I was re-examining the way people did things, and world. I didn't want this kind of hullabaloo that went on. I don't know, we felt it was a very kind of personal thing. I hope my children don't do this to me, I might add. But we felt it was a highly personal kind of thing. And I suspect the war had something to do with it.
Sure, the war had a lot to do with it.
We did tell them, I might add, about 2 days later. We didn't, but as I said, we just got married. We had $50 between us. I remember that very vividly. Out of which the ring cost $25, and it really has held up. I'm still wearing it. And we got a, there was a greenhouse attached to the army post. And there was also a disciplinary barracks there, and I ran a greenhouse. We got the corsage for $1. We paid the rabbi. I remember that we...
The important things.
We utilized that $50, which included the cake, the rabbi, the license, and as I said, the ring.
The way the prices are going, maybe you do want your kids to do it that way. They could do it for $50.
There was another kind of funny thing. I wanted... everybody now wears gold rings, but back in 1942 they were platinum. We really went practically into the basement to find a plain gold band with a jeweler in Leavenworth. And that's about it. I don't know whether that answers your question,
yes,
but I think let's see, I was 24, Howard was 30. I guess I was really having a reaction, and it's a kind of interesting thing, because right now I find that I am trying to hold the greater family together. I mean, not my own children, but the remnants of my parents' family. I sort of feel like they just died a year ago. I sort of kind of feel like... That these relationships should be kept, and I find that I've been going to maybe their funerals, I guess, and family events, and trying to keep track of the cousins, and so that I've come full circle from somebody who was not too interested in maintaining. I think part of it is that the period of reaction that people go through. And I guess the other thing is, you see, I moved more and more out of the norm. I was the last one of my friends to get married. All the others, there were 11 of us who were very close when we went through high school. And the first one got married... rest of the 11, all got married. And I guess I got married about a year and a half after, which really, in point of time, doesn't seem very long. But that year and a half, I had sort of, I was doing things quite different than the other 10 people. I don't think I can answer.
I also think that during the war, it was much more common to elope. And not to have the frills of a wedding. You were in time, also in keeping with the time. That
yeah,
particular
well,
time.
Also you didn't set up housekeeping, right? Mm-hmm. Actually, we never got any wedding presents.
Oh.
My sister, who was 7 years younger than I, when she got married, got people kind of gave her like double wedding presents because they hadn't given friends of my parents and that sort of thing. But we never sent out announcements. Nobody ever gave us anything. And for years, I discovered that I didn't have the junk with quotes around it that people ordinarily get and never buy for themselves. I can't think of, you know,
the servers, toaster batters or something like that.
Yeah, that's right. We never had them. And
oh, it's been so detrimental to your marriage. Well, that's very interesting. How about, did you continue to live in Kansas, or what, did your husband remain
in
the country? Was he sent to
Let's see. He was in Kansas. We got married, and then I had a job in Washington, so I came back to Washington. In the meantime, he got transferred from Fort Leavenworth to Camp Hale, which was up in Hando, Colorado, near Leadville. And he was attached to the mountain troops. See, I took a leave from my job and went out and met him at Leadville. In the meantime, he had got transferred from there back down to Texas. And we had about 6 months of Army maneuvers, and 4 months of Army maneuvers, and then his unit went overseas. So I was with him then, and I went out to Pittsburgh, California with him. He left, and I went back to Washington and continued working, and about a year later, I joined the Red Cross. For 2 years. See, I joined the Red Cross. It was early. It was the end of 44. And they made a mistake. They told me when I joined that they would in no way send me to the same theater that my husband was in. I was due to go to Europe, but something happened. I don't know. They didn't have computers then, but they got something mixed up. And I ended up getting sent over to the Pacific War Theater. So I was sent to Leyte in the Philippines, and he was in Mindanao in the Philippines, and then his unit was moved up, and actually there was a period of time. I was with a general hospital, and he was with an evac hospital, and his patients would come through our hospital. And so we had that period of time over in the Philippines. Then he went on, Japan surrendered. He went on to Japan, and I was still over there, actually, because he had much more seniority than I did, so he got sent home first. And I eventually came home.
Had this experience with the Red Cross and so forth. Your background wasn't nursing.
No. I was a recreation worker in a hospital, in a general hospital. See, it had 20 wards. This was just part of my feeling, which is very, very difficult to reconstruct at this point. But as the war went on, you know, everybody you knew was off. There were two things. One is that I've always wanted to be where things are happening. And the other thing was this feeling that you wanted to do something. And I found that I wanted to get out of Washington, and so there were a lot of people going into the Red Cross from a variety of different things. I had thought about the WACs. They started those women's corps. And they couldn't. They wouldn't tell you whether you would go overseas or to some base, and so the Red Cross, you either joined their overseas service or their domestic, so that you knew that you would get sent with the troops.
Yeah, I know that a lot of people do this. It's just
That was what I did. It had nothing to do with law.
That's what I mean. That's what makes it. I think is kind of interesting because it being that you were working in law in Washington, I didn't live during that time, but I imagine it was quite distracting from pursuing one's own career, certainly. I mean, you felt that was more...
Yeah, I don't think you were particularly career conscious. You were living through a crisis situation. You know, when you also had a feeling like this was never going to end. Actually, in looking back, you know, it wasn't such a big hunk of time. But, you know, when you live through some of these situations, it seems like, you know, it's a never-ending period. And
I lived through that.
Your interest in this kind of career that you might ordinarily just wasn't there. I mean, that wasn't really what you were... And a part of it was is I wanted the experience. I can't explain it, but this seemed to me to be an experience of people of my age group, that all of the men were having this particular experience. I wanted myself to see what was, what was involved, and I think that was the kind of thing. I was able to get the job, though, because during college and law school, you know, I had done, you know, I had worked in city playgrounds, and I had done kind of, you know, vaguely, I don't know, social worky kinds of things, you know, in terms of summer jobs, so that I did have enough work experience that it didn't seem completely out of the, you know, and it was a very interesting experience. I don't know how effective I was. Actually, the most effective, there were four of us that were in our particular house. The most effective one was a very pretty girl from Texas, you know, a kind of rural Southern Belle type, who really was much more what was needed than a more serious kind of person.
And when did you, how did you and your husband go about resuming quote-unquote normalcy after the war?
Well, we came back home. He took some graduate work in New York, and I went back to school there. And partly because I had gotten kind of interested. I'd done work with, you know, some of the psychiatric wards over there. I decided that I wanted to take psychology. And I took some courses at Columbia, and he was doing work at Presbyterian in New York. And we lived on West 11th Street. We were there for, let's see, I guess it was two semesters. And in fact, I took enough credits, I never really did anything with it, that if I had, you know, added the thesis on, I probably would have had a degree. But we then decided to come home. We back to Pittsburgh. He was offered a staff position at Presbyterian here. So we came home, and for, I don't know why I didn't really pursue the psychology. I went back, you know, to my original interests, and the first thing that I did was to get a job teaching at Pitt, and then I
teaching
did
law.
Yeah, and then I did some private work, and then you see, my oldest child was born June 47, so that I got pregnant, let's see, 9 months before that, so we really be in the fall of 46. But I kept on working. I worked straight through them. My David and Ben were born in June, so that I, you know, they weren't so difficult to plan around. Debbie was born in August. Sally was born in November, and I took a semester off. There was no way I could figure that one out. So I took that term off.
Could you tell me the dates and the names of the children again, and okay, the year, so if you can have that on record, and
let
then
see,
we can get into that more.
David is June 14, 1947, and he's going to be 30. Sally, who is Sarah, and who we're the only people who call her Sally. She reverted back to Sarah. We called her Sarah. Little kid growing up, we called her Sally. Sarah seemed so formal. And when she went away to college, she didn't want to be called Sally anymore. And so she...
Sarah again.
Sarah, that's right. and
1940?
No, she's 1950. She's November 1, 1950, and Debbie, who's my handicapped youngster, is August 29, 1952, and Ben is June 2, 1954.
Okay. Do you want to, at this point, since you're mentioning your children, would you like to talk further about how you determined your priorities once you became a mother in relationship to your work and some of your feelings about motherhood and raising them in Pittsburgh and so forth? It's pretty open-ended. Perhaps you could choose an aspect of your experience as a mother that you'd like to talk about.
Well, it was a kind of a period of conflict. I'm trying to think how old I was at the age. I was 28. And,
you were 28 when you had your first job.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, by the time we had room and all around. And I think I really had some real questions, you know, as to what I wanted to do, you know, to stop work. I think Howard's in the house.
I'm just up to
the gang, which stick these back, okay. But anyway, that gives you an idea of what they look like.
Although that's not... At that particular time, you see, most people didn't work, and I had great problems in terms of, whether I should stop working completely, and in order to work, there were all these kinds of problems, you know, of finding the appropriate person to stay with the children and certain feelings of guilt that you had. And it's always very difficult to be different than the rest of the community. And I don't know, I felt very strongly that I would get lost if I didn't retain a certain identity of my own. I can just remember, you know, just feeling that I had to still retain, you know, a kind of independent part. So what I did was, when they were very little, I would try to keep things so that it would be like 3 days a week that I would go out, two at home with the children. Things that I could do at home. But I made the decision that for me, I would just have to keep working. I also loaded the house with help in order to do it, I must say. you could still get somebody like I don't know, in retrospect, whether I would have taken, really would have been taking 10 years off, because the way my children are in age, they're 7 years, the alternate would have been just not to work for 7 years, and going for 10 years and then trying to go back. I don't think I felt sure enough of myself. I think that was the thing that I felt that if I stopped work for this period of time,
couldn't have foreseen Women's Lib, and you couldn't have foreseen that the trend would go in that direction, and this wouldn't have happened, but you could never have known that. Yeah, you could never have known that. Let's wait. I was talking just to, because it doesn't matter. Yeah, now it's gone. Okay, now we can do it. hope you're not expecting another airplane. No, I think it's all right now. Yeah, we'll keep it up. So, okay. That's the kind of thing we really need to know. We really want to know.
Right.
The feelings and the frustrations, if there are any, of what a woman, particularly a woman, goes through to accomplish you have accomplished.
You know, I didn't have to work. It gets easier, you know, in certain ways. If the household is such that your earnings are needed,
you can justify it to other people or whoever it is that you feel you need to justify it to.
Yeah, that's right. I must say, Howard was extremely helpful. I mean, in terms of understanding, we had all kinds of discussions of this before we even got married. That I had these very strong feelings about maintaining my own identity, but I always went back and forth on it a little bit, like. And I really, and it's kind of interesting, I really thought about this lightly with Women's Lib. I remember wanting to maintain my own name, in part because I guess there were no boys in my family.
What was your main name?
King.
Sorry. That's right, okay.
And then I discovered, and this isn't true anymore, this has been changed, but that if I had wanted to retain my own name to practice law, I would have to legally change it. I would have to go back and go through a change of name thing. And that, I remember saying, it seemed to be so pretentious. I mean, it was like I expected to be somebody important, you know, to go through all that. I thought, now really, it isn't. But the one thing that I really, one horse that I really rode, I you know, it also seemed to me that particularly, you know, that made for many complications, so I became Marion Finkel Horse. But I insisted upon being Marion Finkel Horse. I really, you know, feel my identity is completely lost once they just make it Mrs. Howard. Now, I can remember with the Jewish women's organizations, I got called to join them, and I would say, fine, I'll be very happy to join. You know, here's my, I guess it was like $2 or $3, it certainly wasn't what it is now. And I would send in Marion Finkelhor. Now, some of them who knew who I was wouldn't even bother to call, but when the yearbook would come out, it would be Mrs. Howard Finkelhor. And they didn't even put the Marion in parentheses. So I carried on a little running battle with them. And I don't know, that was very important. It still is. I feel that I have an identity, which is my own, and I feel it's very important to protect that identity.
It's enough that you took on the last name, but at least let's keep our own first
name,
otherwise we're...
All right. I also would say that you really have achieved that in this city. You really have.
I think you really have,
and it's a nice achievement for other women. You've done a lot in that way, and not just FemLib and Women's Lib, that kind of
thing.
It's been
done.
Well,
it's a very difficult thing to do without
being identified.
Without really making yourself unpleasant. Let me tell you a couple of things. I served on the board of the Jewish Children and Family Service actually for a number of terms, and it was after I had gone to the law department of the city of Pittsburgh, so that I clearly had a work role that was known in the community. When Jewish Children and Family Service would publish their list of officers, and I was an officer, actually, but board members, they would list the men with kind of their, if they were professional people, they would give them the courtesy, obviously, Dr. So-and-so. If it was an attorney, they would put, James Cohen, Esquire, and all of the women on that board just got turned in to Mrs. James Cohen. Didn't make any, I mean, they just, somebody down there, whoever made up the list,
just automatically put you in that way. So I would get this list, and I would see, you know, James Cohen Esquire, somebody else Esquire, and me, I get, you know, I'm listed as Mrs. Howard Finkelhor. So I remember trying to figure out, you know, how unpleasant did I want to be. I did mention it to them, and nothing happened. there are kind of little things that just go on like that all the time. I think that there's some shift in the thing, but it's very, very hard. I mean, there's a way of labeling women, and it's very difficult to try to...